Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the fourth season of the Sons of History podcast. I am extremely excited. Alan, are you?
I have been looking forward to this season. I've been looking forward to this conversation. So I am ready to go. Ready to go. I just wish I didn't have COVID right now.
Oh, yeah. Yes. That's right. That's right. But you don't seem, you seem asymptomatic.
Well, I kind of got the little burning in the lungs, but yeah, this is the worst it's been. I had a little bit of a sore throat, started on Wednesday, and it's been kind of ongoing. I'm not 100%, can't run a marathon, but yeah, I'm still, you know, infectious. I'm still contagious. So here I am, got to sit here by myself, but you know, I'm energized. I'm ready to go. I drank a bit of coffee. Looking forward to this conversation. And, you know, it's going to be a fun one because it seems like Bill Maher chimed in on the very thing that we want to discuss. So,
yeah, exactly.
When I saw that, I was like going, holy cow, I can't believe that, you know, so many people are going to be talking about this very subject.
Yeah, very, very timely. And speaking of your lungs are on fire, if you were 100%, would you be able to run a marathon?
You know, I did a triathlon one time, and but you know, I really wasn't in good shape. But could I? Yeah, I could probably. You know, I could run a few miles. I used to run about 7 miles, but
yeah, that's one third of a marathon. You know, I would not be able to do it. I'm in relatively good shape, but my legs would not hold up. In fact, I strained my hamstring just the other day playing with Madison, like. I reached for her real fast and I was like, oh, wait. And so she's like starting to come at me and I'm like, get off of me. I just strained my hamstring. So I've been laying on a pack of ice the past couple of nights. So ladies and gentlemen, Alan is playing the role of Celine Dion all by himself. And if you haven't yet, if you're watching on YouTube, click the subscribe button. If you're listening on Apple or Stitcher, Spotify, wherever you're listening, push the subscribe button. Do us a huge favor. If you could give us a 5-star review, that would be awesome. And if you put in there like, hey, I love the show or something along those lines, put something nice. It would be nice. And also tell your friends about us. Speaking of things that are going on YouTube, we've got our Road Trip History documentary, our 2-part documentary on Dwight Eisenhower and Chester Nimitz, both from Texas. We're here in Texas, so we wanted to do something about those two great Texas World War II heroes. So you can check that out on YouTube right now, those documentaries. We do a road trip documentary. Did you have fun with that, man?
Oh, hell yeah. It was, man, you know, going to those two towns, Fredericksburg and Denison, had a great time. The people were great. The food was, wow, fantastic. So I'd like to do it again. I did my own solo trip for the Gulf Coast campaign, which I will be working on. I'm still working on that one. Got some great interviews with Wesley Odom and Mike Bunn. So you know, those I'm still working on. But overall, you know, just taking a trip and seeing where Nimitz and where Eisenhower were born, it's. First of all, the towns were fun. It was fun visiting those two towns. But to actually be in the place where, you know, the great general, great admiral, and one of them who became president of the United States, it's great to be able to visit those places.
Yeah. The people were awesome. The museums were really good. The National Museum of the Pacific War in Fredericksburg was awesome. Like, it was just really, really cool. They've done a great job there. The beer in Fredericksburg, stellar. So we had a great time. Food, drinks, and all that jazz. So yeah, you can check that out. Do us a favor. Like the video. Maybe leave a comment. Maybe share it as well. That'd be great. Speaking of watching our show on video, we are now streaming on Epic TV. The Epic Times picked us up. So thank you to the Epic Times and hello to all of you who are watching on Epic TV. And speaking of things that you can do, you can go to our website, thesonsofhistory.com, and purchase some of our gear. You know what? Speaking of, We've got our Come and Take It mug with our logo on the side. We're out here in Texas. We love the whole Come and Take It. The FBI, not a fan of the Come and Take It, but we love it. And we've got a friend of ours who is a, well, state-renowned sculptor, Craig Campabella, and we've joined with him. This is the Come and Take It moment with the Come and Take It flag. You can get these online. Just visit our website, thesonsofhistory.com. Got a number of shirts. This one, it's a time for choosing. And speaking of, November is coming up, so we've got some choosing to do politically, but we won't get into that. Also, if you haven't yet, Alan, I know you haven't been putting a whole lot of writing together, but I have, ladies and gentlemen. The Epoch Times has been spoiling me lately with a lot of my military interviews. So this is Jack Hamlin. He was in on D-Day, and then I've got another one, Joe Maragula. So this is some really great stuff. They give me all this room, and you can only read my stuff if you subscribe to the Epoch Times. So, anyways, that's enough of a plug there. What do you think, Alan? Did I go too far?
Well, you know, I think we're now on the FBI most wanted list because you had to show them that Come and Take It flag or, you know, that logo. But, yeah, it's okay. You know what? With all the emails and messages I've been sending out, I'm sure I'm on their list too. But, I do have a Come and Take It flag myself. But, you know, on the Epoch Times part, yes, I've been kind of slacking a bit on the whole Epoch Times. But, you know, I've got a mother to take care of. I've got my full-time job that is killing me. So,
yeah.
Overall, you know, I have books to read, research to do. I'll get to the Epoch Times.
I like
right
to think
now,
that I'm. I think
I'll let
I,
you take the spotlight.
I'm, yeah,
on
Yeah, I'm
one.
Carrying the weight for both of us. So you're welcome. Not a problem. Also, they have.
But I do have to say though that I am proud to have you as my history partner, my business partner. The way your articles are just, you know, you're like on the front page. I good job, dude. I'm happy for you. Really am.
Well, thank you very much, man. I appreciate it. You know, it means a lot coming from you, who I sort of respect. So
thank you.
As we always do. Now we've got a very special guest. His name is Philip W. Magnus. He is over at the American Institute for Economic Research. He put together a really good article. There was this, you know, you mentioned it a second ago, the Bill Maher situation. He's addressing the situation over at the American Historical Association. There's this huge backlash because the president of the AHA wrote an article entitled "Is History History?" And the left came out of their boots, as they typically do, the far left. So we are going to be talking about, look, you're pinpointing, you're talking about stuff that needs to be talked about, and a Twitter mob is coming to silence you, and it's really ridiculous. And then you've got the apology from the president of the AHA. It's no good, but we're going to be talking about that, the future of history.
Hey, let me ask you something. You said the far left. I don't think that there is a line between the far left and the left. I think they're all relatively the same. Because the left allows the far left to do the things they do. But I will say that I will differentiate between the left and the liberals. You know, Bill Maher, for instance, I would classify as a liberal. I would even say people like Joe Rogan is a liberal. But, you know, they've awakened. They're not woke. They have awakened to the things that they're seeing in this country, and they are very alarmed by it. So,
well, when I'm saying left, I mean on a political spectrum. I don't mean like a mental.
I don't even know if the word far should even be mentioned these days, because I just don't see. I don't see the difference between the far left and the left when people who want to call themselves on the left allow the things that the far left. And listen, I'm going to, in their defense, in some of the Democrats' defense, because I have friends who are, yes, they have merit when they complain about some of the stuff that happens on the right.
Yeah,
so,
of course they do. Do you see a difference in leftist and the left?
I don't know if they're, well.
You see what I mean? Like, when I'm saying far left, I mean, like, leftist. Like,
you're right.
That's what I'm talking about. I don't want to get caught up in you know, semantics, but yeah, no, I do have a dividing line, because I got a lot of friends who are on the left, Democrats, but it's like center left, and you can have a conversation with them. Far left are people you can't have a conversation with. Sorry. Just like far right. You can't have a conversation with people on the far right. And I've tried. Correct. I know people who are on the far right. And it's just like, what you're saying is, one, doesn't make any sense. So it's like, it's on both ends of the political spectrum. And if you can differentiate between right and far right, then you sure as hell can differentiate between left and far left. Sorry. But we disagree on this first episode of the new season. But what we cannot disagree on is the need to get to This Week in History. You agree?
All right, let's do it.
All right, so This Week in History, we just mentioned Dwight D. Eisenhower. September 24th, 1957, the Little Rock Crisis is taking place, and Ike sends the National Guard to integrate schools in Little Rock, Arkansas. This is from his speech, his about 12, 13-minute speech that he gave the day that took place. He said, under the leadership of demagogic extremists, disorderly mobs have deliberately prevented the carrying out of proper orders from a federal court. Local authorities have not eliminated that violent opposition, and under the law, I yesterday issued a proclamation calling on the mob to disperse. This morning, the mob again gathered in front of the Central High School of Little Rock, Arkansas. I have today issued an executive order directing the use of troops under federal authority to aid in the execution of federal law. The Supreme Court of the United States has decided that separate public educational facilities for the races are inherently unequal, and therefore, compulsory school segregation laws are unconstitutional. Now, the Supreme Court decision that Ike was referencing was the Brown versus Topeka Board of Education, which was decided May 17th, 1954, which was 3 years prior. It was a unanimous 9-0 decision. You know, before then, the issue of segregation had been decided on the Plessy versus Ferguson case of 1896, which held that the 14th Amendment was upheld as long as everyone was treated equally, hence the phrase separate but equal, which stemmed from the Plessy ruling. Now, Brown versus Board was a direct challenge to Plessy Ferguson, and it won the challenge, becoming one of the most well-known SCOTUS decisions in SCOTUS history. Now, our documentary, as we said, of Ike, what he did as a kid, up into the military as a general, Supreme Allied Commander, President of the United States, all that is on our YouTube channel. You can check that out. And actually, speaking of SCOTUS decisions, Alan, next week, we're going to be talking about this year's SCOTUS decisions, a lot of landmark decisions that were made. We're going to be talking with Benjamin Barton. He's a law professor over at the University of Tennessee. So I'm looking forward to that. Your turn.
Okay. So for me, now, mine is this week is not going to be one specific day. It's actually going to be several days. We're going to focus more on September the 21st to the 25th of 1780. And that was the week that Benedict Arnold's plans to betray the nation fell apart. So, you know, if you have read the histories about Benedict Arnold, he was military governor of Philadelphia after he was injured during the Saratoga battles. And he felt like he was not treated very well, mistreated by Congress especially. And there were a couple of generals that went after him, colonels. A lot of military guys went after him. So after a while, he had had enough. He wasn't getting compensated for the money that he had spent. So he started conversing with General Henry Clinton and Major John Andre of the British Army that were stationed in New York City at the time. And his wife Peggy was kind of egging him on. During that time, General Washington had stated to Arnold, you know what, I'm going to give you the left wing of my army, and which is a great honor, but his plans were already set in motion. His plans were to betray West Point. Now, West Point was a very important location. It was along the Hudson River, otherwise known as the North River at the time. There was a big chain that kept ships from sailing up and down that river. And the British wanted it because if they could capture that entire river, let's just call it the Hudson. Again, there's debate whether it's Hudson or North. But if the British could capture the Hudson River, then they could effectively split the country in half. Well, not so much in half, but they could split off New England from the rest of the country. So they told them, go ahead and go to West Point, be the commander there. And when he got there in early August of 1780, he immediately just made things worse in terms of defense of the location. The place just got dilapidated. Did I say that correctly?
Yeah, dilapidated, but yeah.
Yeah, things got kind of weak. He weakened the fortress, and during that whole time, he was in touch with Andre, and they were making the plans. And they decided to meet on the 21st of September. There was a loyalist. He was kind of half and half, really, named Joshua Head Smith. He rowed out to the HMS Vulture, and Major Andre got on board, and they met with Arnold right after midnight, which was on the 22nd, and discussions were made, and you know, it was agreed £20,000, not only if he delivers West Point, but if he can throw in General Washington and several other of his aides and staff with him, that would effectively end the war. And they knew that Washington was going to be arriving pretty soon to stay with Arnold and his wife Peggy at the Robinson House, which used to belong to Colonel Beverly Robinson, who was a loyalist. So that was the plan. Now, Andre was supposed to go back to the boat, but some American Continental soldiers fired on the Vulture, and the Vulture had to sail away, which left Andre pretty much abandoned. So Arnold and Smith were going to aid Andre to get back to New York City on foot. So he hands him civilian clothes, hands him the papers on West Point, and hands him a passport, which would get him through the American lines. So Arnold went back to West Point while Smith accompanied Andre, but Smith didn't go all the way with Andre. He kind of abandoned him as they were approaching what was known as neutral ground. The neutral ground was a no man's land where a bunch of brigands and whatever you want to call them, highwaymen, it just wasn't controlled by either side. Well, as Andre approached, he saw three guys who he thought, based on the conversation, that these guys were on his side. And so he divulged information that, he's a British officer. And if you guys can help me get to, to New York, to Manhattan, there'll be rewards. Well, these guys were not on the British side. They were on the American side. And they stripped Andre of his clothes, and they found the plans. They found them in Arnold's handwriting. And so they arrested him and gave him to a guy named to a colonel named John Jameson. Jameson saw the paperwork, saw Arnold's handwriting, and so he sent a Lieutenant Allen, told him, take Andre up to Benedict Arnold. And he sent the paperwork to General Washington. Look what I found. Well, Major Benjamin Talmadge, who was pretty much like the head of the whole spy network, the Culper Ring, caught wind of it, and he ordered that Andre come back so that they could interrogate him, which they did. But Lieutenant Allen sent the message about his capture, Major Andre's capture, onto Benedict Arnold. Eventually, it was on the morning of the 25th. Arnold was having breakfast, and George Washington was about an hour away when Lieutenant Allen showed up with the information, the message that Major Andre had been captured with all this paperwork, which I'm sending to Washington. Well, Arnold freaked out. He thought, it's over. I've been caught. He went and told Peggy, I have to flee. Otherwise, I'm a dead man. So he jumps on his horse, rides, and just as he's leaving, some of Washington's men are approaching, and he passes right by them and gets on the barge. And the barge takes him down all the way to the Vulture. and shows up. And, you know, Colonel Robinson was expecting Andre to be with him, but it was just Benedict Arnold. And Washington arrives and where's Arnold? Where's Benedict Arnold? And he goes across the river, checks out West Point, sees in what bad condition it was. And when he arrives back, the second messenger who had the paperwork showing Arnold's handwriting and all the messages and the plans for West Point and the weak points, Washington realized, oh my God, Arnold is a traitor and he betrayed us. And he was like, if we can't trust a man like him, who can we trust? And the news got out. You know, Andre ended up getting hanged a few weeks later, and Arnold ended up fighting for the British Army. So that all happened this week in 1780.
Good stuff, man. Always an interesting story. I still try to figure it out, but you are a big fan of Benedict Arnold.
I see him as a tragic hero. He's like Macbeth.
A tragic hero or a tragic figure? Because he's not a hero. He was a hero, but wouldn't you say hero if it was like post, like he died as a hero?
No, he did not die as a hero, but
that's what I'm saying.
You know, there are, I'm going to say that Arnold was pushed and pushed and pushed. I know you and I, we had a discussion about the miniseries, The Terminal List, when the FBI agent says, you know, what would your father say? And, you know, he stated, my father would say that it's not wise to push a man into violence when violence is something that he's perfected. And, you know, Arnold had legitimate gripes. Nathaniel Greene, many other generals, all, you know, Philip Schuyler, all were like, you know, Arnold is really being mistreated by especially the Congress. And it's unfortunate it happened. I can't condone the things that he did after he turned, but it angers me to see what so many, the way they mistreated him. Well, you push a guy too far and anything can happen.
Well, I mean, this is true, and we gave Benedict Arnold his due. I think it was last season we had an entire episode dedicated to him with one of the leading scholars on Benedict Arnold. So that was
good. Yeah, we had Stephen Brumwell, who wrote his book Turncoat. We were fortunate enough to have him with us. So
yeah, and that was a very enlightening, insightful, and fun conversation. He's a fun guy out in England. So, all right, man. So we're going
to
have...
I think he's in Ireland. I think he would take exception to that one.
Is he in Ireland?
Is he Ireland or Scotland?
I honestly, off the top of my head, I can't remember. But he's somewhere in the UK. How about that?
Does that work? We could say the British Isles, those two islands.
Okay. How's that? All right. Yeah. British West Indies. How about that?
I don't want to have to apologize and write a article like the sweet guy did. So.
Yeah, exactly. Like all the harm that you have done. But I'm listening. That's right. And I'm learning. So speaking of Sweet, James Sweet, we're going to be talking about his article that came out, which Alan and I, I thought it was a good piece. And then there was a backlash. Twitter came after him. All these supposed so-called historians on the far left came out and really just ransacked the guy. He issues an apology. We're going to talk about all that. And we'll also Phil Magnus, his article. Before we do, we're going to introduce Phil Magnus, let you know who he is. Philip W. Magnus is the Director of Research and Education at the American Institute for Economic Research and a research fellow at the Independent Institute. He holds a PhD and MPP from George Mason University School of Public Policy and a BA from the University of St. Thomas. Ayo, I say that only because University of St. Thomas is in Houston, which is where we are. So his books include Colonization After Emancipation, Lincoln and the Movement for Black Resettlement, Cracks in the Ivory Tower, The Moral Mess of Higher Education, and The 1619 Project, A Critique. Now, he's also taught public policy, economics, and international trade at American University, George Mason University, and Berry College. His articles have appeared in the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, Newsweek, Politico, Reason, National Review, and the Chronicle for Higher Education. But the article that we're going to be talking about actually showed up in AIER's website, the American Institute for Economic Research, their website, and he wrote an article entitled The Suicide of the American Historical Association. It's a very powerful piece. I encourage you to read it. And without further ado, we've got Phil on the line. Phil, how are you doing?
I am doing all right.
It is great to have you. Big name in the world of economic research. I like to think that you are the American Institute for Economic Research, but no, you've been doing some great work. Tell our audience what's going on over at AIER.
Well, we are actually doing a whole suite of pieces right now on the inflationary crisis, both looking at what it means today and the general erosion of the value of the dollar over the last century, basically since we abandoned the gold standard and moved into a politicized monetary system. So that's been the major news story of the moment, although more broadly, we're putting the shining the light of scrutiny on bad history. That includes everything from the 1619 Project to the general intrusion of Marxism and socialist thought into the academy. So I have a new paper that's coming out very shortly that basically shows how Karl Marx was propagandized by the Soviet government after 1917. And that's what really elevated his stature in intellectual scenes worldwide.
Yeah, well, wild stuff. Uncle Karl, not our favorite person on the program.
Nor mine. So.
But I know, speaking of economics, now this whole inflation stuff, this is transitory, right?
It's been transitory for a year and a half now. So waiting for that transition to happen.
Absolutely. Well, hey, man. So we're going to be discussing your article, The Suicide of the American Historical Association, which is based off of the backlash that took place with the American Historical Association's president, James Sweet, who wrote an article, Is History History? Alan and I, we've read the column that Sweet put out a few times, and I want Alan's opinion too, but I thought it was pretty spot on the issue of presentism. And I thought he brought out some really good points. We can get to the backlash later, but Alan, what was your thoughts on the column itself?
Well, are you referring to Phil's or Sweet's column?
Sweet's column.
Sweet's column. You know, I mean, it made a lot of sense in the way that he was discussing, like, his trip to Africa and some of the things that he saw over there and how they were, you know, not telling the whole story. I believe he mentioned something about 1% of the slaves that went through that area ended up in North America. Majority ended up in other locations, but it seemed like it was all, you know, the whole narrative is to make America look bad. And, you know, the thing that I enjoyed was that it's not that he's saying not to discuss it, but you got to, you know, take things in perspective and not look at things so much from our point of view all the time, because it's not fair. You know, you have to see, you know, I think he mentioned the word Moors or something like that, the method of how people looked at things. So yeah, I didn't see anything wrong with the article. I mean, he looked at both sides. He looked at the people on the right and people on the left and blamed both sides for using history for their own narratives.
Phil, you wrote a piece on that. And we discussed sort of off air, what was it that caused you to be like, okay, I'm going to dive right into this situation?
Well, I was watching the cancel mob come after James Sweet in real time on Twitter. They had posted this column, and I thought, just as y'all did, it was a very reasonable, in fact, very mild column. That called historians to task and said, hey, wait a minute, we don't need to politicize every single aspect of our research to fit 2022. And he goes after the left on this. The left is the majority of the profession, but he also critiqued conservatives on some of the same points. He said that they were politicizing the debate over gun rights by using history as kind of this weapon in some of the Supreme Court decisions. And we can debate that and disagree if we want, but it was a very balanced, well-rounded piece. And within minutes of this thing posting, there's a mob of these academic Twitter historians. These are people that they teach in the history profession. They don't really do much in the way of research, as far as I can tell. They sit on Twitter all day and basically like live tweet MSNBC and scream at politicians. But they descend on the AHA's Twitter feed, and the next few messages are lists of emails of all the board members of the AHA, basically demanding historians write them and cancel this guy, get his job taken away, get him to step down and the column retracted. So I'm watching this, and it's like, the mob is assembled in real time, and no one's speaking out on behalf of the profession. No one's speaking out on behalf of the rigor of the discipline.
You know, I don't know if you were aware that Bill Maher even discussed this on a recent show. I think it was this weekend, and
Absolutely.
I mean, I contacted Dustin and I said, Dustin, you need to see this. This is the very topic we're about to discuss. And you know, I never thought I would see the day that I would be politically aligned with Bill Maher on so many occasions these past couple of years, but for him to even discuss this very article shows how ridiculous the whole thing turned out with with people's reactions.
Yeah, it's not the center left that's the issue. And in fact, people like Mara are seeing this, and they're realizing the insanity that has taken place and really captured large parts of the academy. These are really fringe far left theorists who view that the whole purpose of the academy should be to engage and mobilize in political activism for all of their pet causes. And they think that that's the equivalent of what should be handed to you as a tenured scholarly position in the academy as a faculty member, simply because you engage in activism for the right causes.
This, like you said, this was all done like the Twitter storm from the leftist historians. This happened immediately, and it reminded me, or as you were saying it, it reminds me of the Alito opinion on the abortion situation. That was leaked out, obviously, well before the decision actually came out. To me, it seemed like this was a coordinated effort as well to go after Sweet, like, hey, this piece is coming out. Prepare your guns, and right when it comes out, you need to be doing this, 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 and this. It is, I guess, community organizing on Twitter, and that's what it felt like. Yeah. So, I mean, would you say that that is how, and I don't want to go after the left, like you said, the center left, and I was on Instagram earlier today saying, look, we try to get historians from the left and the right. We don't do far left and we don't do far right, but we try to get left and right, and we want to get in that middle ground. So this is not against the left, this is against the far left. This seems to be the tactic: prepare, and then right when it's released, conquer, and you will shut everybody else out from even engaging.
I think that is absolutely the case. And you saw the speed at which it took place. They had the list of emails ready to go. And there was this one professor that did like an immediate response thread. And it has a list of 20 emails, and all the mob descends on it. And the other thing I noticed on it, a lot of the names that were jumping in to foment the mob, to start these letter writing campaigns, were familiar names because I had clashed with them just a few months ago. I wrote an article that basically discovered plagiarism by a prominent left-wing historian at Princeton. And it was a cut and dried case where he lifted text out of other people's works and passed it off as his own. But when I wrote the piece, I had the same mob come after me and several of the same exact people trying to discredit me because I had sinned against the profession by pointing out an embarrassing truth about someone that they view as a leader of their political causes.
What do you find more disturbing, the Twitter backlash or the apology?
Well, the apology, I think, was a direct and intended goal of the Twitter campaign. I was surprised at how quickly it occurred. So, for your listeners, what happened within 24 hours, James Sweet, who's the author of the column, this very reasonable column, post out basically it was like a Maoist struggle session apology letter. I mean, this thing was appalling to read. He says, the gist of it was, I am sorry for all of the harm I've caused you by writing this column and pointing out that political activism may be discrediting our profession. And it was just obsequious, over the top, almost looked like it was a hostage situation that this guy was being forced to retract his column. And they tweet that out within less than 24 hours after it went live. And you'd think, hey, the mob had gotten what it was seeking, what it was going after. But no, the same people chime in, and their next line is, well, this is a step in the right direction, but it's still not enough. He needs to resign.
You know, he is a historian. Shouldn't he have known that you don't that this is going to lead to enabling this type of behavior? It encourages mob behavior, number one. And number two, as a historian, should he not have known that even if you do give an apology, it's still not going to be enough?
Right.
I mean, you'd think the patterns are pretty evident from previous cancellation campaigns. But what was really galling about this one is I still cannot figure out what he did that was wrong or what he did that was harmful, other than maybe calling out some marginal scholars and said, maybe you should focus more of your energy on doing actual scholarship rather than activisting on Twitter all day.
Well, I mean, I noticed something in your article where you stated that some people were, there was a historian or professor who stated that what you're doing is by even remotely looking like that the 1619 project is wrong, you're giving the right a weapon.
That's it. Exactly. That was David Walsh, who's a historian at the University of Virginia, tweeted out this long thread, and the gist of it was that this is giving our enemies, and by enemies he means anyone to the right of Stalin, basically, is giving them ammunition by suggesting that the 1619 project is something less than scholarly. And he chastised Sweet from doing this from his position as head of the AHA because he thought that this is giving basically like sanction to critics of the 1619 project and saying that, yes, indeed, there are some historical problems with it.
It really is mind-blowing because even in your article, and it's been mentioned a number of times, Nicole Hannah-Jones has actually come out and said, look, this is not a historical piece. Now, they started off saying that it was, but when historians were like, hey, this is not history, this is journalism, political activism with a little bit of history thrown in. I find it just disturbing that historians, supposed historians, are saying, yes, we know it's not history, but that's okay. And you've got associations like the American Historical Association, and we've seen a trend over the past number of years now where the institutions, the associations that we've always trusted, the American Medical Association, academia, our portions of government have just fallen apart, even to like sports and the church. You know, they have fallen apart. The institutions are now failing the American people. Do you see this? Because you call it a suicide of the AHA, and it sort of goes in line with your Cracks in the Ivory Tower book, where higher education's a mess. It's a joke, right?
Absolutely.
Do you think that the suicide of the AHA could be a good thing to where it breaks apart everything and people go their own separate ways and are like, I'm going to do history, and if somebody comes after me, I'm not going to be threatened by losing my position in a prestigious group like the AHA?
Well, that's the sad thing about it. You noted the American Medical Association during COVID basically discredited itself. Public health authorities, people that we have traditionally trusted to give us good, reliable, and clearly communicated information, have failed society on multiple levels. And yes, we're absolutely seeing that in academia. I think the history profession is on the leading edge of some of the problems because it is one of the disciplines that swung the furthest to this far left. It's one of the disciplines that has just embraced activism and run with it. But what that means is when the general public sees commentary from historians who are supposed to be weighing in on the past as experts, they no longer trust them. So it's a suicide in the sense that this is ultimately self-defeating. The fact that they've gone so heavily into the activist world has given reason for the majority of the public to look at them with a skeptical eye. What does that mean for the long run? Well, academia, the more that it discredits itself in this way, academia is currently very heavily funded by the public sector. Tax dollars are used to sustain this entire system. And it becomes a matter of public finance if the academic world is not actually delivering reliable information to the public. It's not actually teaching students the right things. It's not a credible purveyor of these disciplines that we're throwing billions of dollars at. Suddenly the public may awaken and say, let's turn off the tax spigot. Let's cut funding to some of these disciplines that are really not servicing all of the pledges and promises that they were sold to us on when we made that initial investment.
Now, do you think that this form of intimidation, this form of presentism, is going to bring an end to history and, historiography? I have to always mess up that word, but or do you see this as what happened with news, where you had people were mistrusting the news so much, people on the right, that a new outlet came out known as Fox News, and you had talk radio where you're going to have some people go into one form of like a history outlet or a historical association, and those on the left, because they're embracing it. And believe me, I've seen it. I've been to places like Philadelphia, and I've seen how people embrace presentism, while people who see things in a more conservative nature are going to align themselves with a different, there's going to be a competing form of AHA. I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
I think we're already seeing the students are fleeing the history major in droves. Of all the primary majors, the core curriculum in higher education, I think history over the last 10 years has lost more students as a percentage than any other major. It even exceeds like English and poetry and some of these weird studies degrees that are generally not known for their job markets. So the discipline itself is imploding. It's unable to attract students anymore. But the odd thing about that is it's happening at the same time that public interest in the past has never been stronger. We have a continuous stream of historically themed books that are on all the bestseller lists. You can look at any point in the year and you find popular history, not an academic history, but popular history is continuously among the bestsellers. We have people that plan entire vacations going to historical tourist sites. You go see Jamestown or you go see Plymouth Rock. It's a major part of the tourist economy. So people are thirsty for information about the past. They go to popular outlets like the History Channel, and I'm not going to defend the quality of like Ancient Aliens or anything as a television show, but there's at least some thematic interest in the past that is appearing in all sorts of sectors that are outside of the academy at the exact same time that the academy is failing the market test, that students are fleeing it, they're voting with their feet and leaving academic history.
You mentioned well, obviously, we're on the subject of the suicide of AHA, and you're talking about how students are getting out of history, and but the rise of interest in history, it is crazy. Like there are constant, especially military history, and Alan and I discussed that I think last year because Max Hastings put out a column regarding like there are no military history departments in universities anymore. Like we've moved away from military history, but military history is one of the most prominent subjects that people are interested in. And you say, you're going to places like a Gettysburg, or, we mentioned you're out in Western Massachusetts, a lot of American Revolution sites. What do you think is going to outlast each other? You've got the suicide of the AHA, which I guess coordinate that across the board in universities, where you've got historians that are teaching bad history in a lot of ways, and you've got kids that are coming in that hate their country under false pretenses, and they are going to be the future generation. And it seems to me that the suicide of the AHA is an attempted homicide of the Republic. What do you think is going to outlast each other?
Well, I think there's two forces here. First, you do have the activists in the history discipline that are interested in propagating their views, their beliefs, and creating other activists. That they want every student in their classroom to think exactly as they do, to share in that echo chamber of generally far left politics, and to emerge from the university with those exact same set of views. But the average student is not that. The average student is not an activist. A typical student that goes into a history classroom is there for one reason. It's required to get that credit to graduate. So what happens is when the history discipline only offers courses that are aimed at fomenting activism and tearing down capitalism is another prominent theme, playing all these like identity politics themes that seem to dominate history courses, the students tune out. They view those as the blow-off classes that they no longer want to attend. And what it really amounts to, what it comes down to, is now it's just a forced extraction of money out of the pockets of those students and their tuition dollars for a class that gives them absolutely nothing of value that they don't want, that they don't need, and that they're going to forget about as soon as the semester is over. So it ends up being more a waste than anything to sustain the career of a very small but very vocal and loud group of professional activists who are masquerading as scholars.
Would you say it's a tiny minority, or because wokeism seems to be very prevalent in education, and what is it, 60%? I think I read where 60% of kids in schools support socialism. I don't know. I think we've lost a couple of generations there.
It might be the fact that they shut down for 2 years during COVID also meant that those messages were probably not delivered in the most effective way. So I think academia is still shooting itself in the foot. I guess another way of saying it, yes, they're certainly having an impact on the culture. They're certainly affecting the way that people think about American society. But at the same time, they aren't doing it in a way that's convincing. They aren't doing it in a way that's robust to challenge. So what you find is people may leave those classrooms with a superficial adherence to some of the political beliefs that are propagandized to them. But just the slightest scrutiny from another source is going to at least get the intelligent among them to start asking questions.
So I checked the comments on that Twitter feed of the article of James Sweet, and I just reading through them and then checking the bios of all of those people that were leaving stuff, and it was him, he, him, she, her, they, them, Ukraine flag, and I just thought, like, are we really going to cater to people who are saying this is how history really is? And there are also people who can't figure out what gender they are.
I mean, that's the fascinating thing is the history profession and most of academia has become an ideological monolith. There, and this is in the data. We have data of college professors' opinions, whether they identify on the left, right, or anything in between. They've been doing these surveys since the 1960s. And academia has always been kind of on the left of center, including the earliest survey that came out in, I think, 1969 was the first year. And it was pretty stable, though. It was like 40 to 45% of the academy was on the left, and then moderates and conservatives split the difference between the remainder. So they're minorities versus a plurality on the left. But it was stable from the 1960s to about 1998, 2000, thereabouts. There's almost no change in the number of professors that identify on the left. And then something interesting happens around 2004, 2005. The left starts growing and it's off to the races. So the most recent survey that came out, they've topped 60% of all faculty. And that includes people in the hard sciences that are not overly political, although even that's changing. And then you get into disciplines like history, it's 80 or 90% of the faculty all have the exact same political views. And that's what you see on these threads. And what it does is it creates an intellectual laziness among the historians. They no longer have to defend their positions with evidence. They no longer have to articulate even what their beliefs are. It's simple enough to just shout them or put the flag in the Twitter bio. Or so one of the most common responses to Sweet after his column appeared, in addition to just pure profanity and bile screamed at him. is, "Shut up, you're a white male." And that's not an argument. That's if anything, that's like a racist and sexist discriminatory take. And those are some of the nicer ones. A lot of them used epithets and profanity to do this. I sit here asking myself, could you imagine going to a professional conference or association in your field, your discipline, if it's academia or if you're in the private sector, just a trade show or something, and you're sitting there on the panel and someone disagrees with what you say, and they stand up at the microphone and start screaming profanities at you and attacking your race and gender. That person would be escorted out of the conference, asked to leave, and with good reason. And yet that's become the normal discourse of academics on Twitter anytime they're confronted with opinions or really evidence that they dislike.
Now, was this all brought about by so-called historians like Howard Zinn, or, because in 92 they were going to celebrate Columbus and his the 500 years, and there was supposed to be a big celebration in San Francisco, which was canceled because apparently there was a huge backlash. And prior to that, there was, Columbus was a hero. We were taught that in school. But yeah, it's what you were saying. Something happened where in the last couple of decades, this country has just turned, not just this country, but I want to say Western civilization as a whole. Something has happened where people are hating their culture. They hate themselves, self-loathing. What is it that did it? Was it just one book that created a whole bunch of disciples, or?
I think it's much deeper than that. I mean, I think bad books in history are very symptomatic of deeper trends. The biggest thing that I think is going on here relates to a shift on the political left. Because you used to, like in the mid-century, mid-20th century, someone on the political left tended to be like an old school liberal, someone who valued free speech, individual rights, civil rights, all sorts of causes that were probably more politically popular on that side. But it's like the old ACLU types. They'd stand up to defend free speech, even though it was very unpopular speech sometimes. That has given way to the rise of kind of like this identity politics, critical theory version of the left, which is much further to the left, but it's also overt in its embrace and celebration, even valorization of what they call an emancipatory activist cause, but it's all defined within relationship to their own political priors. So activism is fine if it's of this one particular stripe, everything else is evil and has to be shut down and diminished. You throw on top of that, there's been a crisis in the jobs market in the history profession since probably about the late 1980s, certainly by the mid 1990s, and it's only accelerated since then. History PhD programs went on a production schedule of just churning out degree after degree after degree, far too many degrees relative to the number of jobs that existed in academia, even at its normal projected growth rates, let alone in a discipline that seems to be shrinking because students aren't interested in it anymore. So what happened is they produce all these PhDs, they don't have enough jobs to hire them, jobs become increasingly scarce. Well, when professors retire, the newer generation comes in and they get to make the hiring decisions, and suddenly ideological agreement with the echo chamber becomes an easy rationing mechanism to decide who gets the job or not. So instead of screening all of the candidates, hundreds of candidates may apply for one position. If you can eliminate 50% of that pool by only advancing candidates that agree with your politics and openly signal that in their letters and their application packages, well, then you've cut the stack in half. And you can go even further by tailoring the hires to people that are just pure political agreement with what you happen to have. And if the left is the political majority in the discipline, as it absolutely is, what it means is almost all new hires are going to be handed out to other activists.
But what changed? Because, and you can correct me if I'm wrong on this one, but about 90 to 100 years ago, the Frankfurt School came here to the United States, and they brought with them critical theory. But, in the 80s, I went to school in the 80s, and there was no wokeism. There was, I mean, everything was still of the conservative nature. Did they, did, was there a cabal that just decided, hey, we're, you know, if we're going to change society, we have to start with education, or did it just come naturally? I mean, this is what I'm trying, and I'm sure many of the people are trying to figure out, how did this come about like this so suddenly?
Exactly. So I don't think it's any conspiracy. I mean, never attribute to conspiracy what incompetence can explain. But what I do think is there has been a change in the way that the left thinks about the world, moving away from trying to do rigorous, empirical, fact-based scholarship into advancing narratives instead. And narratives mean, when you embrace that approach, it means that evidence doesn't matter as much unless it props up the narrative you like or destroys the narrative you dislike. So there's been an epistemic change that comes with this whole critical theory approach to studying the past, because you have a political goal that's the end game. The political goal drives everything. That means that evidence is strictly a tool, a weapon to be used one way or another to advance that. And you've seen a real decline in the standards of rigor in the discipline that has accompanied this political shift. And this has really accelerated, I think, in the last 15 to 20 years. There were some undercurrents of it, but you may remember it was about almost exactly 20 years ago, the Michael Belial episode. This was the guy that wrote a book called Arming America. And it was supposedly proved that gun culture and the revolutionary generation had been exaggerated for political causes. And he claimed to have all these probate records and evidence that showed it. And this book won all sorts of awards and acclaim, was featured in the top journals, and eventually wins the Bancroft Prize, the highest ranked prize in the discipline. Well, it turns out that the guy had fabricated his evidence. And when people started asking, hey, can we see the records you're citing? They found out, oh, well, some of them were destroyed in the San Francisco earthquake fires in the early 1900s. Others, he claimed, well, my office had a flood or something in it, and I lost the records. And it turned out he couldn't reproduce his own results. Well, what happened 20 years ago, the discipline was still honest enough to retract the prize, to penalize him. And there was a fight to get that to happen. But I asked the question, could that happen today? With a similar acclaimed historian on the left that's advancing a particular narrative of an activist nature, gets caught in outright cheating, outright fabrication, plagiarism, you name it. Would they retract that person's book prizes and drive them out of the academy? I don't think they would. I think, in fact, the exact opposite would happen. They'd circle the wagons around them. The Twitter mobs would descend on anyone that dared to challenge them, and the profession itself would basically carry that person through. In fact, they may even give them prizes and awards to bolster their reputation under criticism, as we saw happen with Nicole Hannah Jones in the 1619 Project. It gets a Pulitzer Prize at the exact moment it's under scrutiny from an older generation of historians.
To an extent, it takes a lot of courage to just outright lie. And we always hear, we hear the same phrases and terms. Much like Sweet's apology, I apologize for the harm. I'm listening. I'm learning. But something along the lines of what you're talking about is like, oh, this was so bold. This took a lot of courage, you know, to really push against, you know, the narrative. I find it irritating and ironic that it's always, you know, they really pushed back against, you know, the narrative and different, like, no, you are the narrative. You're just going along with it, and you've been protected to lie. And it seems like we're sort of inundated with lies and half truths. And a book like the one you were referencing earlier is still going to be utilized as a source. Like, people will still use it as a source. I mean, like, this, you know, because a lot of people are not going to know what happened. I didn't know, you know, what happened to this book, you know, that was only 20 years ago, but people are not going to know that this took place just offhand. And that, I want to ask you, what are readers supposed to do? And I'll give you an illustration. 1619 Project comes out, your buddy, Matthew Desmond, you know, he puts together a piece, that is American capitalism is brutal. You can trace that to the plantation. And you sort of blow that up. And the fact is, though, is he utilizes a source, Edward Baptist, that had already been, like, guys had already pushed back against him. Like, no, this is inaccurate. But Desmond used it anyways. and it moves forward. And it's like when people are going to look at your sources and they're going to say, oh, this is, you know, Edward Baptist, and he's a professor of history at Cornell. So obviously he knows what he's doing. It's going to be viewed as a reliable source, and therefore Desmond is going to be seen as a reliable source. How are readers, just regular, average, everyday Joes and Janes, supposed to go about figuring out if they're being lied to or not? I see it as almost an impossibility.
You hit the nail on the head. There is the problem, is the sources that some of these really shoddy works of history are using are stacked upon other sources that are equally shoddy, which are stacked upon other sources that are shoddy. So, you know, the old saying is that a lie makes its way halfway around the world before the truth even gets its shoes on. We're absolutely facing that in the history profession right now. I try to do my part by picking certain battles and areas where I think I can make a contribution, areas where I have some background and expertise that I can relatively easily step in and say, hey, wait a minute, Ed Baptist fabricated his GDP statistics and misused evidence to come up with a very faulty thesis here. But the problem is we're always playing like a catch-up game to the next level of lies. And this comes from, I think, back to the more fundamental problem that the history profession right now is entirely uninterested in policing research misconduct among its own. In fact, if you call out research misconduct from someone who is advancing the narrative that they want to see advanced, you are the bad guy. This happened to me a couple months ago when I went after Kevin Kruse of Princeton. And that was the plagiarism case. All of the attacks and the answers that come out of that wing of the profession, which is the majority of the profession, are not, well, he plagiarized. Maybe we should consider trying to get this book retracted, or maybe he should have some sort of academic penalty assessed against him, as would happen to any student in the classroom who did the exact same thing. No, the attacks were all, Phil Magnus is an evil right-winger who's funded by dark money. Here's the conspiracy theory version of it. And, you know, if I had even a nickel for every time I had been accused of being this conspiratorial agent of a moneyed interest, I would have retired a decade ago. You know, I'm not doing this stuff for career advancement on my own end. In fact, you know, one of the earlier battles I was involved in was a book called Democracy in Chains by Nancy McLean. That also happened to really engage in some problematic and I dare say outright fraudulent archival representations. I happen to know a lot about it, and I wrote one of the very first published reviews of it. And the attacks were, oh, well, the Koch brothers and moneyed interests must have paid Magnus to go after it. At the time, I was an untenured teaching professor on like a 4-3 course load at a small liberal arts college economics department. And I got a call one day randomly from a higher ed reporter who had been fed all this information by one of these crazy conspiracy theorists in the discipline that said that I was making like millions of dollars to tear down this book. And I'm like searching for an apartment in Georgia as I'm moving to this college on a salary that was maybe like a third of the salary that Nancy McLean herself is making at Duke University. So it's a real, it's a cry-bully phenomenon that you have in the discipline. All the people that are attacking and spreading these types of responses to anyone that tries to hold them to account, they tend to be at Duke and Cornell and Harvard and Princeton and these elite institutions. They do tend to be the majority in the discipline, and yet they constantly present themselves as victims. We saw it in Sweet's case as well. They claim to be victimized by having to read this very mild-mannered column telling them that their Twitter activism was something unbecoming and less than professional for a historian, and yet they're somehow the victims of it all.
You know, the part of the reason the First Amendment included the right, the freedom of the press, was the founding fathers felt that a free press would keep politicians honest. Yeah. Well, you know, now I see them working with the political parties, but not only that, but now another form that we use for free speech is big tech. You know, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. And seeing how those organizations, those forums, are now working with political parties, I mean, what are your thoughts on the future of history, because I could post something that's factually correct, but you're going to have a one of those, what do you call them, the truth? This is why I hate... what's the fact checkers? The so-called fact checkers are going to sit there and say, no, that's not true. So, you know, I get concerned sometimes with things that I post that are, you know, historical based, because I've been attacked. What do you see? What's the future for history with big tech the way it is? And
I've had direct experience with this exact phenomenon as recently as about a month and a half ago when the new GDP numbers came out. It showed the second quarter of GDP decline, which is the historical technical definition of a recession setting in. Now, the Biden White House did not want that for political reasons to be said. The fact that we were technically under a recessionary period because GDP was declining and had met this definition. So what did they do? They sent out their press agents to declare that this isn't the real definition of a recession. And I had shared a post, I think it was on Facebook, that really called this into question. And like a day later, a fact check is slapped upon it. And, you know, here I am, someone who's an economic historian working with economic data on a regular basis. I've taught textbooks that use this exact definition. This is something that's very, very well established. Yes, there are other definitions of a recession, but this has been something for the better part of the last half century, a consensus position in the discipline. And yet it's getting fact checked by one of these social media companies, usually relying on an article that's written by a 20-something with an English degree who's purporting to weigh in on advanced economic matters or advanced historical matters, you name it. So this is a real problem. What we see on top of it is the government, I think, has put its finger on the scale, and some of the Freedom of Information Act data that's coming out is really bringing this to the forefront right now. We see people at the NIH and Anthony Fauci meeting with Facebook and Twitter executives to tell them what should or should not be permitted. We see people in the White House putting pressure on Facebook to declare things disinformation. And normally that's for the very politically salient stuff of the moment, but it does venture into history. It does venture into other areas of scholarship. And it's almost always the case that the person doing the fact check is not a qualified expert. What they're doing is they're cherry picking from politicized so-called experts that they find in the academy. And you can find someone in the academy that will support almost any crazy opinion you want at the moment. And then they'll proclaim that person an authority because it agrees with their pre-existing political stance. And next thing you know, you've got a fact check that's slapped on the post, irrespective of the evidence or the truth.
Speaking of circling the wagons, it seems like the left has taken over all the institutions and have circled now just individuals and have circled the Bill of Rights to crush that. It's no longer concerning. Like it used to be concerning. Now it's just outright dangerous. And we've got so much history to go off of over just the past 100, 150, 200 years of seeing this take place in countries that looked very, very stable, until they became destabilized by, as Sweet states, the articulation of competing politics. That's all we're doing. And we're strictly going by which party is going to win. Not what the truth is, but what is the outcome? Are we going to win? Or are we going to let our enemy win? It's very dangerous, what's going on. Phil, thanks so much for joining us, man. We've had a great conversation. And I knew it was going to be. We had a historian friend of ours, Dr. Jody Edward Ginn. He's over in Waco now. He's over like the Texas Rangers Association, but really cool guy. He sent me your article, and then I sent your article over to Alan, and I was like, let's try to get him on the show. And luckily, our mutual friend David Randall over the National Association of Scholars, I was like, hey, man, give Phil a nudge so we can get him on the show. But thanks again for joining us. Hope you had a good time.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for being here, and thank you for the article. You know, we need it. And by the way, I forwarded your article to I don't know if you know Dr. Mary Graybar.
Yep, I know Mary well. So.
Okay, so I sent that to her, and she was very receptive to it. So, and I know she wrote something about this this case also. So,
yeah. So a few of us are pushing back, and the profession needs it at the moment.
But the thing that surprised me the most was this morning, a buddy of mine sent me a link on YouTube, and it was Bill Maher and talking about this. I was like, oh my God, we are just about to discuss this today. So.
Exactly. So maybe people are waking up. So that's all a good sign. And I don't have the biggest platform. Y'all don't have the biggest platform, but having the truth on our side can actually make a dent. So.
Yeah, I think we can break up, I guess, people whatever it is that we're talking about, I think can be broken up into three groups. There's heroes, there's villains, and then there's cowards. And James Sweet started off on the right foot, but not a villain, but I would say he's definitely turned into a coward based on what has taken place. And it is a shame, but I hope that Sweet and other people that are in that position get a backbone and say, you know what, screw it. We're not apologizing anymore. And for two reasons. One, we're not wrong. And two, an apology doesn't do anything.
Exactly.
So, well, Phil, thanks again for joining us, ladies and gentlemen. Follow Phil over at Twitter at Phil W. Magness, MAGNESS. And you can also read a lot of his stuff over at the AIER, the American Institute for Economic Research, does some freaking awesome work. He's also got a number of books, which we'll discuss later at the end of the show. Phil, thanks again for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks again.
All right. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we hope that you enjoyed that conversation. It is the situation we find ourselves in, and it's not a good one. We love history, Ellen and I know, but what is taking place, there is that combative nature of what historians are doing in academia, not all of them, but a lot of them, too many of them. And then the personal interest that a lot of people have in history, which is why there's so many books and movies that are being made based on history, and big events. Alan, what do you think about the conversation?
Well, as usual, great conversation. And, it's important that people stand up to these bullies, really. I know you and I, we've had this discussion before where if you see a bully beating up on a victim and the victim fights back, prior to the victim fighting back, nobody does anything. They just stand there and they grab their cameras and record. But as soon as the victim fights back and starts beating up on the bully, all of a sudden everybody else gets a backbone. Well, I want to say that I think someone like Phil is that victim who fights back, and I'm hoping that there's going to be people who are going to stand up with him. I can't say much for Sweet. I don't know what to say about Sweet. I hope that he'll learn an important lesson. But someone like Phil is going to be. He's that guy that stands up to the bully, and he fought back. And we mentioned Dr. Graybar, who same thing. Mary Graybar. We all need to stand up to them, because I myself sometimes am quite concerned about something that I'm going to write, or an article that I'm going to write, or an opinion that I'm going to write, because I know I'm going to be attacked. And it's not just, who am I? I'm not David McCullough or anything like that, but
yeah, you're not dead.
Yeah.
Which he is.
Not
God
yet,
rest his
anyway.
soul.
So but we can't let history, we can't let people intimidate us into silence about not just history, but any subject. So this goes well beyond history.
Yeah, absolutely. And so we've all got to get, we've all got to stiffen the backbone and just tell it like it is, man. And that's not easy. I'm not going to say, oh, it's no problem. It's just like, even if you're not concerned about like backlash as far as what will happen to you personally, even if you're like, there's nothing going to happen and maybe nothing will happen, and you're like, whatever, you just don't feel like dealing with the headache. I think that's a lot of the case too. Because a lot of times I'm like, I'm going to post something, and then somebody's going to say something, and then I'm going to feel obligated to explain all of human history to this individual. And it's just like, and then they're still not going to go and listen to anything that I just said. So I get it, but at the same time, we got to push back.
Well, sometimes you can't get through to some people. You know, when we've had discussions, I've had discussion. I don't even know if I want to call it a discussion. I had debates with some people on the issue of slavery, since we're talking about the 1619 Project. And the thing that I'll always hear as their response is, y'all just don't want to talk about slavery at all. And I'm like, well, no, it's not that I don't want to talk about slavery. I do want to talk about slavery because we can learn from it, but you need to paint the big picture. And when we do the book recommendations, there's one book in particular that I'm going to mention that touches on this very subject, that you know, you don't want to focus everything on a particular narrative, excluding all the other information just so you can achieve a political gain. And like I said, when we do the book recommendations, I will mention the book and I will mention the passage.
Well, speaking of book and movie recommendations, you want to go ahead and get started?
Yeah, let's. I'll give you the honors, Your Honor.
Well, then the honor is all mine. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, so I've got a couple of recommendations book-wise. Obviously, Phil Magnus, he's written a number of books. He's written, I think we mentioned at the very beginning, there's like a little fuzz thing. The 1619 Project, A Critique. He goes about it from more of an economic perspective. And I did mention the Matthew Desmond piece, which, you know, tries to utilize the King Cotton phrasing or whatever, that got all out of whack. And, you know, Phil really tackles that. But he goes from more of an economics perspective. And also another thing, Cracks in the Ivory Tower. That's one that you need to read, just especially if you're in college or you want to know what's going on in academia, or you've got kids that you're wanting to push into university. It's a good thing to know. And speaking of, there's another one, and I spoke to John not too long ago, the author of this book, John M. Ellis. He was professor over at, I think he still is. I don't know if he's retired just yet, but he's been over there for about 50 years, UC Santa Cruz. And I think he's one of the founders of the California Association of Scholars. But this, The Breakdown of Higher Education, this gives a really good explanation on what has happened over the past 50 years in academia. And we talked about, and Phil sort of touched on this, where you've got a particular ideological group that is now making all the decisions and hiring decisions in academia. And John does a really good job of breaking down that situation, among many others. And then also our good friend Thomas Sowell, The Vision of the Anointed. This book opened up my eyes to so many insane things that are going on with people who think, I'm just trying to help people. I'm trying to do the best for them. In other words, I want to dictate what they're going to do. And it is, this book is more or less the phrase, good, you know, the path to hell is paved with good intentions. Like, this is that phrase in a book. It's really alarming. So we are in the fourth season. Speaking of movies, we are in the fourth season. This is episode one of the fourth season. You think you're excited for the fourth season? I intrigue, or I encourage you to go check out. Do you watch Stranger Things, Alan? Have you ever watched any of that?
No, I don't watch too much TV. I watch The Walking Dead, and you know, but I have a lot of Blu-rays, and I'm reading half the time anyway. So
yeah, me too. Well, they just did the fourth season of Stranger Things. We're in our fourth season. I thought the parallel was pretty good. I don't know which one I was more excited for, the fourth season of Stranger Things or the fourth season of The Sons of History. Either way, they're fantastic. So if you haven't yet, go check that out. If you've never watched the show and you're an 80s baby, you're going to love it. You will love that show, even in the 70s and 80s, even into the early 90s. But yeah, you got to be sort of an 80s baby to really appreciate that show. A lot of great stuff. Go ahead, Uncle Alan.
All right. Now, last year, I did mention this movie once. I finally got it. It's actually a Disney movie. This is before, I think, Michael Eisner. This is before Mike Eisner took over Disney. So back then, they used to have a whole lot of wholesome, non-woke filming, and this was one of them. Now, Night Crossing is about two families who escaped East Germany when it was a communist nation. They rode on a hot air balloon. You know, there were about three attempts. They show in the movie, I think, two of them. But on the last attempt, they got in a hot air balloon. And I mean, I'll let you watch it. Obviously, it's a good movie. I enjoy it. It's not a great movie, but it's a pretty good movie. And it's good for people to understand what people went through under communism when we had the Iron Curtain before the Berlin Wall fell. You know, prior to the Berlin Wall falling, you know, there. If people who know their history know about what went on in Czechoslovakia, Poland, East Germany, Romania, many of the other countries. But this movie, it came out in 1982. The events were in 79, but it has John Hurt. He was the guy that in the movie Alien, where the alien came out of him. There's a Jane Alexander. She was real big in the 70s. Beau Bridges, that's the Big Lebowski's brother. Then there's a Doug McKeon. You'd know him as the kid on Golden Pond. And finally, Gunther Meisner. Now, who is he? Well, if you saw the Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, he was Mr. Slugworth. So kind of evil-looking dude. And he was an evil dude in this one, too. So if you get a chance, yeah, it's Walt Disney's Night Crossing. So that is my movie.
And you're back to... Get that IMDb. You know,
it's too bad I don't have a window like the old Dave Letterman where I can just kind of throw it behind me and crash the...
You should do that.
The crash window side. Okay, so what I want to do, instead of just talking about one book, there are actually a series of books, but I want to concentrate more on two authors. One of them is Michael Walsh. We had him once before. I have three of his books. Last Stand, The Devil's... Pleasure Palace, and The Fiery Angel. Now, why read these books? Okay, they are historical in nature, but they're also quite spiritual in nature. There's a lot of, there's a lot of religion in them, especially not the last stanza, but the other two. But he introduces us to, the Frankfurt School and critical theory and how, you know, the critical theory pretty much ruined American education. If you read the books, you'll get a better understanding of what critical theory is. I'm not talking about critical thinking. We're talking critical theory. But like I said, they are very spiritual books, very religious books. You know what religion he is. He's a Christian, of course. But I've enjoyed the books, and it'll kind of give you a good grasp of what has been going on in this country, how this is a spiritual fight, and it has led to much of the wokeism and cancel culture that we see today. So get yourselves a copy of those books and read them. Now, the other one, now you mentioned Dr. Thomas Sowell yourself. So I've got several of his books, but this one is quite interesting. And I'm bringing this one because of the subject matter that we were discussing. But this one's called Black Rednecks and White Liberals. He has in here a whole section on, like the real history of slavery. And one of the things he talks about is, and I remember this, the TV show Roots, the miniseries that came out in the 70s. And they, they questioned Alex Haley saying, you know, this doesn't seem to be quite factual. There's a lot of myth in it. And Alex Haley admitted, yeah, there is quite a bit of myth. But Dr. Sowell was saying that, and... You know, it's on page 114. If you do have the book, he talks about how when you're going to instigate people to get angry or agitate, are you really doing the country any good? Are you really doing people any good? When you divide people based on, in this case, race, the long-term effects and the short-term effects are actually, there's going to be negative consequences. So, you know, if you're going to present something as historical fact, you better have the intentions better not be bad, where you're dividing people over something that's not even factually true. And this is Dr. Thomas Sowell stating that. So get the book. he like I said, there's a chapter in there on the real history of real history of slavery. He puts things in perspective on the fact that this was a worldwide phenomenon that has been going on since the beginning of time. Americans don't have a monopoly on the industry. We didn't create it, but boy, we are the ones that are blamed for it all the time. And it seems like it's just us. I could go on and on about some other things, but for the sake of time, I will cut it right here.
It is the topic of the hour, that's for sure. Well, ladies and gentlemen, if you've made it this far, be sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel. Or if you're listening strictly to the audio version on the podcast, subscribe, leave us a rating and review, preferably a 5-star rating if you would be so kind. And also tell your friends about what's going on here at the Sons of History. You can check out our website, thesonsofhistory.com. Follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook as well. Hey, man, it's like 70,000 views on that video that we never even created, right? Yeah, go Jaws. Yeah.
That was, yeah.
Yeah, it's hilarious.
Well, I will say that that's a good way to introduce history to some people, because yeah, otherwise they may not even know about it.
Yeah, absolutely. The USS Indianapolis, that scene on Jaws is one of my favorite scenes of all time. All right, ladies and gentlemen, well, that is it. I'm Dustin Bass, and who are you?
I am Alan Joaquin. Don't forget me, man. I know I'm not there, but, you know, I'm there in spirit.
Oh, you're here in more ways than one, and I will tell you this. It does me good not to have you sitting next to me. All right, ladies and gentlemen, well, that is it for the show. God bless you, and we will talk to you later.